This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to episode number 3.
All right. So today is a very special episode.
Yes, it is. I'm excited.
Yeah, for two reasons. One, we are talking about what is probably our most highly requested topic, RxJava. And two, we found the perfect person to chat about RxJava with.
Yeah, and so that said, I'd like to welcome Dan Liu to the show. Dan, I had recommended your series last time in the Awesome Picks, and as Kaushik said, we got a lot of feedback from people saying, look, we love the testing episode, we really want to know about RxJava, and there's a few other topics, but RxJava is probably one of the top ones up there. And so what we thought is like, hey, let's just do the listeners a favor and let's get Dan on the show. So how's it going, Dan?
It's going great. Thanks for inviting me on this show. I think this should be fun to talk about.
Yeah, it should be great. I'm really excited to have you on. I know that I initially learned a lot about RxJava and kind of had the real aha moment, honestly, when I went through your blog series about RxJava. I had written a few little test projects with it, but your series really helped make some things click, and I really appreciated that. So thanks.
You're welcome.
So let's go ahead and have you introduce yourself to the listeners. Basically tell us, you know, who you are, maybe where you work, and what you spend your time doing with on Android.
Yeah, my name is Dan Liu. I'm a serial programmer. Like, I found out that's what I love to do. About 5.5 years ago, I had a friend who was going off into the mobile app world, and I kind of joined him. And over time, became mostly focused on Android. So I worked with him on Mobiata and FlightTrack, which then later got acquired by Expedia. So I worked on the Expedia app for a few years. And then for the last year, I've been working on the Trello for Android app.
Nice. So Trello is an independent company now, previously with Fog Creek, right?
Yep.
So have you met Joel Sposky?
I have, yes. We've hung out once or twice at like company. The company flies us all in. So Trello has a bunch of remote workers. I think maybe like half of our workers are remote. But twice a year, we fly everyone into the same spot to spend a week together.
Nice, nice, nice.
So do you go to New York City a lot? Because that's where Fog Creek's at, I believe, right?
Yep. Yeah, I've been there 3 times now.
That's awesome. So, Dan, you've created a couple of open source projects that I know that have some following. Would you mind telling us a little bit about some of those open source projects and what they are and what they do?
Sure. One of them, one of the ones that I use most often is JotaTime Android. And that one is actually just built on top of JotaTime, the normal Java library. But there's one or two like crucial things that make this library in particular good for Android. Most importantly, the way that Jota's built normally requires extracting resources from the jar itself, which causes some serious memory issues on Android. This library helps out by using the actual assets, that normal asset resources that come with Android.
Why would someone maybe want to use JotaTime Android as just compared to the regular calendar or date objects inside of, you know, Java Android?
Oh boy.
Oh man. The built-in, the normal calendar and date setup on Java is just, it's so easy to make so many mistakes. just the way the API's design seems to be built for confusion. And so the way JotaTime is set up is a lot less confusing, has a lot more clear fields that you can set. Most of the data structures are immutable, so you don't run into these problems where you change one field and it has these weird side effects on the other fields. But also importantly for Android in particular is that the version of all of your time zone data comes from the operating system itself if you're using the built-in calendar. And that data can go stale really quickly, and if the user's device doesn't update, which, surprise, that happens quite often on Android, that means that you can lose out on a bunch of information. Like, for example, I think three years ago or 4 years ago, Russia, 1 week before daylight savings time was supposed to kick in, decided they're not going to do it. And from then on, for the next few months, pretty much everyone's app was off by an hour for Russia. And if you were using a library like this, you can actually import the latest version of the TZ data and then not have to worry about that problem.
So that's funny. I just read it recently. I watched a YouTube video on why developers hate time zones and working with time zones and why we depend on libraries. I'll have to link it up in the show notes, but it's just a hilarious walkthrough. All the problems that we have with time zones, and he actually covers a very similar case, such as the Russian time zone, where a country just says, forget it, we're not doing it this year, and screws up everyone's code. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Interestingly, JotaTime, the Android version, was actually the first project that I came across of Dan. I mean, that's how he came to know of like this person called Dan Liu. I mean, I saw your Jora Time project and I was like, huh, that seems interesting. I was using the native Jora Time. I never used your library. I think someone sent me a link or something. So I had a look at that and I was like, huh, this sounds interesting.
It's cool. So do you have another app? And what was how do you say it? Is it GuyCat? Maybe I'm totally butchering
Giphy
the name.
GiphyCat. We missed an F. Okay, yeah, GiphyCat. So GiphyCat is the service that some people wrote where it basically takes any GIF and converts it into like WebM and MP4 because that's a way better format than GIF. Because GIF can be like, you know, 5, 10, 50 megabytes large, and then the equivalent video version, because it can actually use compression, is like 500 kilobytes. So what this app does, it basically, if it detects a GIF link that it can use, it will actually send it to GiphyCat and then display it on the screen. And the interesting thing about this project is that I got to use this was kind of one of the ones where I cut my teeth on RxJava on, and it's open source, so you can go check out like what I did there.
So we can kind of hop in the code and see how you used Rx inside of there?
Yeah, although I really ought to look at it again, because maybe I would have some better ways of doing it now, but that was one of my original forays into RxJava.
Cool, that's awesome.
Nice. Does Twitter use a similar approach for their GIFs? I mean, I remember reading something along these lines where they either use like a very similar approach to sort of like displaying GIFs in their timeline.
It's becoming a very popular method. Like Imgur, which is a huge image sharing website, also uses that now. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Twitter decided to do that as well, because it's such a huge bandwidth savings.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so a third project I've been working on, this has just been released like the last couple weeks, and I'm really excited about this. Design came to me and said, like, we're basically working with scalable vector graphics the whole time, like SVGs, and we're having to take those and cut them into PNGs for you. Is there any way we could, like, not have to do that work? And so we looked around at a bunch of solutions, but ended up coming with our own, and we call it Victor. And basically what it does is you define some source sets where your SVGs are located, and then in your build, it'll actually spit out the PNGs equivalents of them in all the different densities that you want. And my favorite part about this project is that it doesn't pollute the source code. Like, a lot of the solutions that are out there right now will generate PNGs from SVGs, but they will do so in a way that ends up in your source folders, which makes it hard to modify later.
So at what point does it actually do it? Is this basically like a compile time thing? So like at the time of compilation, does it generate the assets and does it like cache it? And what's the mechanism that goes into this? Does it make sure that it only generates the PNGs for the assets like once and doesn't do it twice, or unless you run a clean? Or what's the mechanism there for this?
Yeah, so there's actually a pretty new mechanism that it's using where, so every build of Android has multiple application variants. So that's kind of a cross product of your build types and your product flavors. Mm-hmm. So you might have a assemble debug and assemble release. Those are two different variants. Each variant, you can actually call a method called register res generating task. Register res generating task is a note to the Android plugin that says, here's a task that you need to run before all the resources are merged, and then here is the output directory where those resources are located. And so that allows us to plug into the Android plugin, and then on top of that, Gradle adds all of these capabilities for incremental builds, which allows us to basically only do the work that is necessary. So like you said, if you don't do a clean and you run the same build twice, it won't have to regenerate those SVGs each time.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's very useful, actually. Recently, I've been using a whole bunch of these material design icons, and essentially what I've been doing is the whole process manually. So I pick some of the SVG icons that they have, and I have like this bash script that I've written that automatically generates the PNGs for the asset sizes that I want, and I've just been doing this manually. So this will be pretty cool. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm really excited to check out this project, too. I saw you posted a couple of days ago on Twitter, and I sent it to the teammates with my current client, and I know the design team was pretty happy about it, and so were the web guys, because web guys use a lot of SVG stuff as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. It's very early in development, and so there might be like, you know, maybe we screwed up something pretty bad, but hopefully it'll work out, and hopefully it being open source means other people can help out and make it better than it would be if we just made it on our own.
You told us a little bit about how you got into development in general. Now, you said you joined a mobile company that was acquired by Expedia, I believe. Now, were you always an Android developer before you joined that company, or did you do Android only at that company and that point forward?
Yeah, so that Mobiauto was this travel company founded by my friend Ben Cazes, and he was one of those people who like struck gold when he made an iPhone app really early on in the App Store. And his original app was Flight Track, which just told you where your flights are early or late. Nowadays, that's something that's like just built into the operating system itself because it's so important. But like back then, that was pretty big money. And so he just, you know, I would have just taken the money and run, but he created a company instead, and he hired me on. And so funny enough, I actually didn't have a smartphone until I started working there. The first thing I did on the job was go and buy a G1. And within the first 6 weeks, I pumped out our first Android app, which is a hilariously bad app. But it was really good to like kind of cut my teeth on these early days where the design bar wasn't quite as high as it is now. But it was very excellent. Like, you got such a rush from being able to deliver something. Because before that, I was working on like enterprise content management software, which just saying the name causes you to fall asleep. And here, you can take something you wrote in a couple of weeks and show it to someone, and they can play with it and actually appreciate it. So I got super addicted to that. But for the first year, it was a small startup, so I was working on a little bit of everything. And once there was enough people, I kind of focused on Android because that was my favorite part of the job.
That's awesome. That's cool to hear. I do remember those early days of the G1, and all my apps are horrendously embarrassing as well. So I can relate to you on that front, on the G1 days.
That's interesting. Almost every developer that I've spoken to, at least a serious Android developer, has always had the G1. Like every single person I know has had the G1. That's very interesting. I should start collecting and take a survey and like make sure that this is actually true.
Well, you know what? I have a couple of G1s that I can sell you if you're really interested.
Nice. I had a G1 too, but I sold mine pretty early.
well, back then, I think there were like only two phones you could even buy, and the G1 was one of them. So
right.
That was it.
Yeah, it was. Exactly.
So Dan, many people basically go to your blog. I know I frequently go and see, I follow your blog because you have posts on all kinds of subjects and really useful sort of nuances to Android development that you otherwise wouldn't catch from just, you know, working on Android. So how do you stay on top of Android development? I mean, if I wanted to learn, I would probably go and see your blog or maybe Don's screencasts and the bunch of other things he releases. But I mean, how do you make sure that you're on the bleeding edge or you're using the best techniques or you're trying to work on things that help push the platform forward?
Yeah, sure. First of all, like, I don't know how I get into it if I got into it now. Because I have the luck of having been done this for so many years now that I could kind of build up that knowledge gradually. But in terms of what I do these days, I just a lot of different links. Probably the most top level are Android Weekly and Android Dev Digest, because those kind of like collect some of the best links from any given week. So that's like necessary reading.
Android Dev Digest? I wonder who runs that thing.
Yeah, I bet
someone
cool. Yeah, so there's those, and then I'm a voracious RSS user. Like, I love RSS, and pretty much any time I stumble upon another Android blog, I just throw it onto my RSS feed. So there's that.
So I don't mean to interrupt you, but what? This is a good question. What RSS reader do you use? Is it for desktop or is it for your Android client, or how do you consume those? That seems to be a big problem nowadays. Now that Reader's gone.
Yeah, I'm one of those like can't stand new things people, and so I switched to the old Reader. is the actual name of it, and it's the closest to Google Reader.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool.
So I do that. I listen to a couple Android podcasts that are up now. Thank you for your podcast, because it's been a great addition.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I love attending meetups and conferences and talking with other people. That's a really great source of tons of information. Lots of research on the job. I've been lucky enough to be at jobs where I wasn't so crunched for time that I could actually spend a couple days researching new topics. So, for example, Victor, the Gradle plugin we just released, came out of the fact that I could spend a few days just researching Groovy, Gradle, and the Android plugin.
That's awesome.
It pays off really well, but it's hard to justify a lot of the times to companies up front, because it's one of those things where it's like, well, you haven't produced any working code in 2 days. That's fine, but I'm going to produce some awesome code in a week. So
Right. That's a very valid point. I mean, I had the same thought about RxJava initially. I mean, it's hard to say like, hey, I'm going to like take a month off and just learn this thing called RxJava, because there's a huge benefit potentially in maybe a month down from now. So, but yeah, I mean, it's always amazing to have these kind of situations where you're allowed to learn, because in the end, it does benefit the company without a doubt.
Yeah, it's just, if you're in a crunch time, it's hard to justify it.
And it is. And when you're in a small startup environment, it's very difficult. And Dan, possibly you can relate to me on this. And when you work remotely, it's even more difficult to get that time, because you don't have that office time. You're not with your coworkers. And so if you have that 2 or 3 days where you haven't made a Git push and nothing's happening, I start wandering towards your direction. And people start asking, well, what are you working on? What have you been doing? And so you feel that pressure building. And if your company doesn't have that openness about them to allow you to research and do that type of personal development to grow your skills, it can get a little stressful at times. So I can definitely relate.
One thing you can do in that situation is I always get super excited about whatever I'm working on. And so I just can't help it, but I'll take like some of the key things I learned and like post them in the chat logs. Just so other people learn a little bit, and also just because I can't help but share.
That's a great idea.
So other places, I actually am the sole moderator of Android Dev on Reddit, and the more
Holy
people have been
cow,
joining...
Wait, I didn't know that. I really didn't know that.
Yeah,
I spent a lot of time on the Android Dev Reddit thread as well, but I had no idea you were one of the moderators there.
Well, the other moderator is a bot, so it doesn't really count.
So Dan is the moderator.
Yeah. I am looking for someone else, but at the moment, I am the only one. And then I found like just giving talks and writing posts really helps solidify my knowledge, because when you write a code that works, you might just say, okay, it works, call it a day, I'm done. But when you want to give a talk or write a post, I really don't want to give people bad intel. So it causes me to go and research kind of all the aspects, some parts that I didn't even think about. And that actually really often helps me just as much as it helps anybody who might be reading it. And then when all else fails, Google is always a great solution to find out information about Android. I use that all the time.
Definitely. Yeah, writing and giving a presentation on a particular topic will definitely give you a reality check on how much you think you know. And I can definitely say that firsthand. For when I was writing my first book, I thought I knew almost everything there was to know about Android, which was Android 2.1 at the time, or 2.2. And I got into it and realized, like, wow, I really only know a fraction of what I thought I knew. So, all right. So, Dan, when you're learning these new things, how do you go about it? How do you go about learning new things in your day-to-day job? I mean, we've learned about where you kind of stay on top of Android development, but what's your process maybe that you have for kind of picking up new things?
Usually I need to like have a definitive problem to solve. I tend to pick a project and try to solve it, and then whatever I need to learn on the way is how I get it. It's hard for me just to like read a technical book without any actual application that I'm working on.
If you were to like mentor somebody, maybe like a junior Android dev at your company, do you have any tips that you would give anyone in that situation?
Yeah, a few things. Obviously, I give them like a million tips related to whatever specific tasks they're working on. But in general, there's kind of like three things that I really push. And one is to just learn, for Android in particular, learning Java best practices is really important. Because Android's just a framework, and Java has been around for much longer than Android has been around, and there's a lot of people who figured out really cool patterns and really cool ways of doing things in Java, and it's sad if you kind of forget all of that because you're focusing on just Android. The second thing I would definitely suggest is to use the Android source code as a reference, because one of the great things about Android is that it is open source, so you can actually go and look at exactly what's happening. And there's countless times where I've wondered, why is this code not working? And then I can actually step through and find out. And I think when I was an younger developer, I was much more afraid to look at the source code. And now that's like the first place I go to see what's going on. And then the third thing is I love to test new code in like a small project, a small clean room project. because oftentimes, you know, code builds and builds and builds, and suddenly there's many moving parts, and you have to kind of dodge one while building another. If you're writing a new feature, it might be nice to try it in some small clean room where you can develop that idea and know how it works on its own before trying to integrate it with the rest of your code.
That's a really powerful point. I mean, I've used that sort of approach many times. Like, recently we sort of had to re-implement a part of like the camera in our app, and I was like, I really don't want to put this code into the existing code because I don't know how it's going to interact. Or more importantly, it's nice to isolate the problem or the feature that you're trying to work on, just because then you know that any change that you make would explicitly cause an effect, versus like suspecting that something else from another piece of code is actually causing the problem. So dealing with it in isolation is very powerful to sort of solidifying your concepts and reassuring yourself that the code that you write actually makes the difference that you anticipate.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, another point with learning Java, the core Java practices, there's a seminal piece. It's called Effective Java. It's a book called Effective Java by Joshua Block. I'm pretty sure any person who's serious with their Java development has at some point run across that book. We'll add a link to that to the show notes. It's an amazing book. It has fantastic patterns, and it's like an evergreen read. You can always like go back and read the book, and you always have something to pick up and learn from.
Yeah, I have an admission there, which is I actually didn't read that book until a year ago, and I'm kicking myself for the fact that I didn't. It's such a great book.
Oh my god, just imagine, like, once you're done with the book, imagine how much more amazing Dan's going to get. Yeah. So, where do you draw your inspiration from? Like, you said you worked on a couple of Android apps, Dan. So, like, what are some of the apps out there that you look and that, what are alternative sources of inspiration that you find?
Yeah, there's a few apps that I just love and, like, use almost daily. And, like, I'm not, I tend to look at new apps when they come around, but here's a few of the ones that I just love using myself. Mm-hmm. Timely is just amazing. Like, it's this great marriage of beautiful design, but also extremely functional. Mm-hmm. Pocket Casts, before I got to Pocket Yes. Casts, I like did the most manual podcast ever, just downloading MP3s and putting them in Music Play. And Pocket Casts is the first podcast app that really clicked with me, and I love it. And they did a material design update, which is great.
Yeah, we're all big fans of Pocket Casts here.
Yeah, Reddit News, because I read it a lot. And that's, again, there's many different Reddit clients. That was by far my favorite. Musée is this background, live wallpaper that Roman Nurek made. And it's great because it's got a new background every day, but it's also just some beautiful interactions going back and forth between the background and actually viewing the information about what artwork is being displayed any day. I use GReader again because of RSS. And GReader can download the old reader. It's pretty well set up. And then last, LinkBubble is this great app from Chris Lacey. And it basically, whenever you click a link, it pops a bubble up so you can view it in a floating web view instead of having to take yourself out of context and go to Chrome or something like that. And
that's cool.
I love that one because it just shows you what you can get away with on Android. It's super fun that you can even do this.
I'll have to check that out. I haven't played with that one. That sounds cool.
And then, you know, I love, there's this blog called Android Niceties, and they tend to post some of the best apps out there. So almost anything that goes on there, free or paid, I'll download because I just want to check out what's going on in the world.
Nice. So in a previous life, you were a gamer, right, Dan? Is that
previous.
Correct?
If by previous you mean I was playing Heroes of Might and Magic for an hour this morning, then yes.
How is the situation with Android games? Do you play a bunch of Android games?
I do. I mean, they tend to have a shorter lifespan, games in general, on mobile. But yeah, there are some games that I love. I've been addicted to Threes recently, because everyone is. I love Hoplite, Rhyme to Capsule, Wordiest is fun.
Nice. Have you ever like looked into making an actual Android game? Because I understand it's pretty different from the traditional sort of app development that most of us do.
Yeah, I haven't really. That's not really been too much of an interest for me. I decided long ago that it would be much more fun to play games than to make games.
I understand the sentiment. My brother is actually also like, he was like a professional gamer. Like he represented India for Quake 3 in its time. So
oh, wow.
I,
mean,
I really understand how gamers think. I've never been personally a gamer. That was because I've had a traumatized childhood. Like every time I would play with him, he would just like completely destroy me. And then I realized, hey, you know, I'm probably not good.
Well, there's more and more cooperative games coming out these days. So
Right. So what's your setup traditionally like? This is something, again, that I'm very fascinated. I usually like seeing other people work, like their setup and how things work. So if I had to pair with you, Dan, what would your setup typically look like?
Extremely boring. I use stock for almost everything because I just, you know, a lot of people love configuring things to high heaven, and I just have never had any desire to do so. So I use stock Android Studio. I don't change any of the quick keys. I don't change the theme. I think my Mac background is the default background from like two versions ago.
That's awesome.
You know, I got a keyboard and mouse, and I have a second monitor, so that's pretty nice, but that's pretty much it.
Many gamers that I know who are also like sort of turned into development, like they have like a gaming mouse, and then they say basically, no, the position isn't like perfect. I need my mouse to move exactly like this. I mean, do you have any such sort of like needs?
Not really. Again, like I got one of those low-level Logitech mice. Works just fine for me.
Does it have a ball in it?
No, I got past that. I have a mouse pad that I bought maybe 12 years ago.
Oh, goodness.
The closest I got is I used to be very into Guitar Hero and Rock Band, and I bought a custom pedal for that. That was about as close as I got to this extreme hardware things.
Was it like engraved with your name on it?
No, so that the default Rock Band pedal is kind of just this flimsy piece of plastic, which is fine for most playing, but if you're playing like really hard songs, it can kind of fall apart on you or snap in half as it has on me. And so someone actually took a real drum pedal and then added electronics to it and sold it to people so that you could hook it up to your game.
Yeah, that's some dedication there.
That's what I was saying too. That's funny. That's all cool information. Do you use, like, for your emulators, do you use a regular emulator, or are you like me, do you use Jennymotion or both, or what's your preference?
Pretty much Jennymotion the whole time. Just the first time I used it, I was blown away with how fast it was, and I haven't gone back since. It's got a couple of neat features too, like being able to see, zoom in and take screenshots and video pretty quickly. So that's my development emulator of choice.
Cool. Right on. Cool. Well, I think that kind of wraps up the basic information about your development environment. Thanks for sharing that. I think there's a lot of great tips in there. I'm a huge advocate for a remote workforce, as I've kind of been very vocal about on social media. And Dan, you work remotely for Trello. Can you tell us a little bit about what your experience working remote has been, and maybe a couple of the tools and methods that you and the Trello team use to stay connected on the same page?
Yeah, I've actually been doing remote for like almost 6 years because when I joined Mobiata, my friend Ben Cazes just like moved to Ann Arbor, and I was like, well, I got a lease, so see you later. And ever since then, I've been doing remote. I think Trello does a really good job of remote in particular because it's just they're very thoughtful about how they set everything up. So first of all, it's very useful because we use this like application called Trello to organize a lot of our data and work. So I highly recommend that. We also use Slack for a lot of chatting. Mm-hmm. But one of the cool things that I really like is just making sure that remote people are included and setting things up so that remote people aren't slighted in any way. So, for example, one common problem that companies have when they go remote is they'll have these meetings where one person will be remote and everyone else will be in a room somewhere.
Yes.
And the group of people in a room will be looking left and right and talking to their friend and chatting, and they all laugh, and they don't realize that none of it is being picked up on the microphone. And so the remote guy can raise his hand and be like, hey guys, I can't hear what you're saying. But no one really, like, I'm not saying they don't care at all, but it's hard for them to like make it a priority.
Right.
Whereas at like Trello, if we're going to have a meeting and there's going to be anyone remote in the meeting, everybody does it from their own desk.
That's awesome. I like
so everybody's kind of on a level playing field. So like, yes, some of the people might be able to be in the office together talking, but then if there's an audio problem, no one will make it a priority. And this way it really becomes a priority.
I like that a lot.
That's a very nice approach. Yeah.
I think Aaron Hammer, which is the lead for Happy.js, which is a Node.js server framework, he recently released a blog post about how he manages the remote team for the Happy.js team. And he shares a lot of those same sentiments, and I completely agree with all of them. I'll put a link to the show notes in there. And Dan, I don't think we mentioned this in the introduction here, but where are you located?
I'm in Minnesota.
Nice. The tundra. Is it cold up there still?
No, actually. It's been unseasonably warm. So I think it's like in the 40s or 50s right now.
Oh, wow. I remember when I lived up there, and I left in 2011. It was snowing May 5th, so you're definitely in a warm streak.
Yeah, well, this year it's warm. Last year it was like still frigid at this point in the year, so you never know here.
Interesting. So I guess we've covered a whole bunch of things about Dan Liu, the person. Now I guess we should jump into RxJava, and this is a topic that I guess everyone is super excited about. I'm super excited about RxJava, so let's get going with this. One of the biggest problems, at least with RxJava, is it has a very steep learning curve. Everyone I go to, I have this problem. They say, oh, I mean, RxJava sounds like an amazing concept, so can you point me to some resources where I can get started? And usually it's been very hard for me because RxJava is not something that you can maybe just grasp in like an hour of reading or something. I thought we should probably start off there. Like, how does one actually get started with RxJava? Right now, most Android developers, like, I guess the de facto thing is to just point them to Dan's Grokking RxJava series. Again, this was a recommended pick by Don last time. So definitely that's usually how, I mean, I start off with. After that, making use of RxJava in specific examples is hugely helpful. I remember what Dan was saying initially about GiffyCat not having, like, if Dan was to write GiffyCat again with RxJava, he would probably change a bunch of things. And I have that same experience with this repository that I actually have on GitHub now. It's called Android RxJava, a very unique and amazing name. So what I basically did was I wanted to understand how RxJava actually works. So what I tried to do was I thought of examples, like real life examples. Like if I was to use RxJava today in an Android app, what are some of the applications? And I just started like flushing out these examples. And then as I did those, I sort of like tried to understand how these operators work. So that's typically how, I mean, I would suggest someone get started today with RxJava. Do you have anything else to add, Dan? Like, what are some of the things that you would suggest in addition to obviously your blog posts?
There was another pretty popular post on GitHub. There was a gist that was also kind of along the lines of learning RxJava. But honestly, like, I was pretty much dragged into RxJava by my coworkers because I fear new things. And It was a lot like Git to me, because when I first learned Git, I didn't really learn it. I spent 3 weeks just being mad at it, and then something and then something clicked, and I was like, "Oh, I get it, and this is amazing, and I love it." And the same thing happened with RxJava. It was a few weeks of me just being pretty upset at it and not quite understanding why we were doing it, and then clicking, and then being like, "All right, this is awesome. Let's use this all the time."
Now, do you use RxJava in any of your production apps today? I know you do in GiffyCat, but is there anything else that you guys use it in production?
Oh yeah, I mean Charlo's got it all over, because that was where I got introduced to RxJava. Okay. We had heard about it and we wanted to try it out. So Charlo, like, if you are using Charlo the app, you're seeing RxJava all over the place.
As a side note, I absolutely love Trello. I love the app. I've been using the Android app since it first was released. I've probably been on every version, and it's just been getting better and better and better. So whatever you guys are doing right now, keep doing it. It's awesome.
Thanks.
No problem. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what is RxJava. Dan, would you mind giving us maybe a little, you know, kind of introduction, kind of a bird's eye view of what you feel RxJava is, so the listeners can understand it a little bit better? Because there's a lot of people out there that don't really know what RxJava is, or they've been in the situation that we talked about before where they're time crunched, so they don't have a lot of time to learn. And so a lot of people have been asking us, hey, can you cover RxJava? I'd like to learn a lot more about it. So maybe even take it from a bird's eye perspective of someone who's never seen it before, so they might be able to understand it.
Yeah, from a very high level view, it's basically the observer pattern, in that you have some observable that emits items, and an observer that reacts to those emitted items. It's super high level and not particularly interesting, because you're like, well, I could do that myself, you know, right? I could code that myself, but RxJava takes this idea and extends it to the extreme and gives you all these great things to work with. So basically, the whole time you're working with streams of data from observables, and then observers who react to it. But along the way, RxJava adds all of these operators which make it easy to transform the data as it's streaming through. It adds a lot easier error handling. So if you have a multi-step process, you can kind of handle the error in one place instead of having to handle the error in 50 different places. It adds easy concurrency. So if you have a lot of the times if you want to add concurrency, you have to set up async tasks or something like that, or threads, all these nasty solutions. Whereas with RxJava, it's easy. You just call a single method and it suddenly throws all of your process onto another thread. And another thing that's cool about it is it's highly composable. So if you have a bunch of different transformations of your data, you can mix and match them. You can pass around these emitted items wherever you want, basically.
You know, you talked a little bit about transforming, and we do, you know, error handling, schedulers, and so forth. Is there any example that you might be able to, if you had a junior developer joining today at Trello, and you wanted to tell them, look, here's the best way to understand, here's an example of why we would want to use RxJava. Is there an example you could to illustrate why RxJava is powerful and why you would want to use it that's understandable to a brand new beginner?
Sure. Let me think about that for a second.
So I remember like one example. So assuming you have like a network call that you have to make, and then based on the results of that network call, assuming you have like two or three other network calls that have to go. So let's think about one common situation is assuming you're searching for hotels. So the first thing that you have to do is maybe pass in your local GPS coordinates to the Places API. And then the Places API would return like a bunch of JSON objects with like the hotels around you. And then once the user like selects that, or maybe like from that hotel, you want to find out what if there's an availability, if you can book or do something. So from the callback that you get from the first response of the network call, you want to shoot out to more network calls. Like you want to maybe get the price for staying in that hotel, and then you want to see if there's availability like from two different services, and you want to club those two again, and then you want to spit out the result all together on your screen in one shot. Like you could typically do this with an async task. Again, like Dan was saying, all this is very much possible without RxJava. But, Oh, man, with RxJava, it becomes a joy. I mean, that was one of the reasons I really loved RxJava. Even, like, these sort of, like, simple or, well, not necessarily simple, but, like, these mundane sort of tasks where it isn't, like, too much for a product person to come and ask for, right? They're like, just collect this data from here, from there, and then just show the results nicely in a screen. What makes it a joy is that it's, again, you get to work with something a little new, being able to compose these operators. There's something about it that makes it so easy. It allows you to think about the problem in isolation. So I was saying, like, essentially, there's like there's network call one that gets a response, and then you have two simultaneous network calls. You could very easily approach this with RxJava by just composing operators. So you could start off with one, then like based on the observable that emits the events, you could like combine those two sub operations by just chaining operators. So RxJava is essentially just three things. Like, at least when you start out, think about RxJava as being just three things. One, observable. Two, a subscriber or an observer. And three, the subscription. So there are these three fundamental concepts. Again, really, like, wrap your head around these terms. Like, when someone says subscriber or they say observer versus an observable, like, you should really understand what they mean, because an observable is very different from observer, even though it sounds very similar. And that was initially, that was my big problem with RxJava. Like, I found all these terms being thrown around, and there was always this sort of cognitive load in my head, because when someone was saying an observable or an observer, it took me like 5 seconds to first understand, wait, okay, observer, that's the thing that listens to stuff. And then you have the observable, and that's the thing that like sort of emits the stuff. So really try to understand those three fundamental concepts, what an observable is, what a subscriber is, and what the subscription essentially is. So the observable is typically where all the fun stuff happens. That's where you have like these bunch of operators, you chain them. All that happens in like the observable section. The subscriber or the observer is basically the three methods. Like if you've used RxJava, you see people using RxJava, you have the on next, on error, and on complete. That's basically all the subscriber observer sort of logic happening there. And once you link these two together, once you have your subscriber connect to the observable, what results out of that is basically sort of a subscription. So basically, if you understand this, then you progress to the next step.
Excellent. Yeah, I think one thing about that's important to note with RxJava, and this is a tweet that I'd sent out a few weeks back, is that RxJava, like Git, just like Dan had said, it comes with a steep learning curve, and it takes a while. And remember the first time that you actually first understood Git, and that light bulb went off, and you thought, aha. And from that point forward, you realize there's no way that you could do development again without Git. RxJava is the same way. There's a steep learning curve. As soon as you're able to understand what observables are for, how to use subscribers, and how to handle subscriptions, you immediately get that another aha moment, and a whole slew of opportunities and possibilities open up inside of your day-to-day development.
Yeah, so I've had enough time to think now of an example.
Cool, that's awesome. That's great.
A relatively simple one. A common thing that you do is you're given an ID and you want to grab the data from the data that's that ID represents from the database. So if you're writing this just normal, you can have a method that returns the data given the parameter of the ID. Or you could write something that, instead of returning just the data, returns an observable of the data. Mm-hmm. And instead of just returning the data straight, you're returning essentially a future for that data. This gives you some cool things. One is that you can request that data at a later time. You can basically prepare the request somewhere else and then request it at a later date when you actually subscribe to that observable. But the other cool thing is that the composability part, you can take that observable now and compose it with any other observables that you might have. So if I have two pieces of data that I want to load before I show my activity, I think Kaushik was getting at this, you can coordinate that without RxJava, but with RxJava, I can just say, I have my two observables, I'm going to use this operator called combine latest, and that way I can wait until both of the data is available before I start showing it on the screen. It becomes just a lot easier to compose this data together.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, RxJava is amazing for these kind of sort of like asynchronous sort of coordination of stuff happening, different events flying around. Now, there is RxJava, and again, if we didn't make this clear, RxJava is basically just a library. I mean, that's part of the beauty of it. I mean, you can use it in any core Java application that you have. It's just a simple library. That's RxJava.
Now, what does Rx stand for? I mean, I think it's a good thing to cover. We haven't talked about that. What does Rx mean?
Go ahead, Dan. You probably
Reactive Extensions.
Boom.
and Reactive Extensions, this actually came from Microsoft. They created mm-hmm. the first Reactive Extensions. And so that's very important to note.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's sort of my understanding of the history is that it sort of comes out of the functional programming paradigm. Not that you should call Rx functional programming, but it's functional programming ish. Mm-hmm. It has hints of it.
And so the guys over at Netflix created the RxJava, so created a Java version of the Reactive Extensions. And to note, Rx has become very popular in a lot of other languages. So even if your company, maybe you write Android and you're going to use RxJava, but your company also has the same problems on the server side with, you know, having multiple streams of data and concurrency problems, you can also look at other implementations of Rx. For example, there's RxJS for JavaScript. I think there's Scala versions. There's, of course, .NET, Java. You could just go to the Reactive Extensions website, which we'll put in the show notes, and you can see all the different types of implementations. So it's not just for Java. We just happen to be talking about the Java implementation.
Yep, that's right. And along those lines, there's also something called Rx Android. That's basically like a plugin for using RxJava in Android. Now, again, you don't necessarily need Rx Android, but it does provide with certain niceties that make it much more easier to deal with in Android. So Dan, would you like to like sort of like give us like a quick gist on Rx Android? Because you are like, you have made like significant contributions to Rx Android, right?
Well, I made one contribution. There's I think the biggest thing that it adds is it has a scheduler that allows you to run code on the main thread. Because that's all the time you're writing code where I want all of this stuff to happen on an IO thread. Because I'm requesting network, but mm-hmm. then I want to display the results in my views. And obviously, you can't modify views outside of the main thread, or your app will blow up. So it's really great that it has the scheduler for the main thread. The thing that I added was this lifecycle observables, which allows you to automatically unsubscribe from your subscriptions based on the lifecycle. So if you subscribe to an observable in like on create, then by the time it gets to on destroy, it'll automatically unsubscribe so that you don't leak any references.
Nice. So typically the bind activity, the bind fragment, those APIs were basically what you worked with?
Some of it. Bind activity and bind fragments are slightly different. It solves this other problem, which is just it's a really, how do you call it?
Let it out. Come on.
It's a real corner case problem of timing that might happen sometimes. So it's specifically to avoid emitting any items that onto the main thread after the activity or fragment has paused.
I guess as we cover some of the other things, we'll get back to RX Android and like some things that specifically you can make use of. Like, for example, you mentioned the Android schedulers, the main thread. Schedulers in general are super useful, and I guess we'll cover that in possibly a future section. So we'll get back to that when we sort of talk about that. Another interesting thing is specifically thinking in RxJava. It's not necessarily very simple for people to grasp RxJava, and that is because it's based on a functional sort of programming aspect. Typically, things are imperative, right? So like you have statement one, you have statement two, you have statement three, and these execute in sequence. Now, what we're essentially saying is with this sort of event-driven programming concept, you have like a bunch of events flying around and you're basically just reacting to all of these, right? So that's one thing I found was a little tricky to grasp with, especially if you've not done too much functional sort of programming initially. But let's talk about some of the specific benefits of RxJava. I mean, like in the end, what we've been talking about is like, yeah, sure, there are like amazing use cases and it's sort of, there are these funky, cool things that are a joy to work with. But what really are the benefits of RxJava? I mean, like, why should I be using RxJava, right? As I mentioned, bouncing between threads is very easy with RxJava. Now, I don't have as much experience like the two of you in sort of Android development. Correct me if I'm wrong. If I had to quickly hop between different threads, how easy is that to do right now?
Not too easy. I mean, that's in any language, I guess. It's not really, you know, what's the joke that people say? You know, they write like a new thread. The problem with threading is, and then all of a sudden they mangle the next few letters together.
I mean, so like, here's like a common use case, right? So I have an app. I make a network request, and then I basically want to give the user some feedback saying, hey, I'm popping up maybe like an alert dialog or something saying, hey, we're with the progress spinner saying your network request is happening in the background. And the minute the network request is done, you want to like maybe insert something to the database and then remove that alert dialog, right? Basically, it's very difficult because like what you're doing is like you're going on the background thread because you can't make network requests on the background thread. So you go to the background thread, but then you want to show a progress spinner. So you have to like come back to the foreground thread. You show the foreground thread. The minute it's done, you make a database operation. So you have to like go back to the background thread. All these things is basically very tricky to do. At least like it was very tricky to do until RxJava came. And basically the way it's done is with schedulers, right? Does that make sense so far? Or
no, I mean, it does. I think that a lot of people may be wondering, okay, I have these different schedulers. What exactly, you know, I kind of, I'm hearing what you're saying, but if I'm brand new to RxJava, why would I want to use a scheduler? Maybe is it because I'm going to make a network call? And I think that's the big case is that you can have various different observables, and you don't have to tell that observable right then and there that, hey, by the way, you're going to be done in the IO thread. You can just create this observable, and then using chaining, you can chain different things together. And then through this huge observable chain, at the end, when you're actually subscribing to it, you actually want the work to be performed, you could say, hey, I want to subscribe to this on the IO thread. So basically saying, like, look, all that humongous amount of work that's going to go out to the network 35 times and hit the file system and all that stuff, I want that to be done on the IO thread, so not on the main thread. And then, hey, when you're done and you've wrapped up all of your work and I need to know the result, hey, when that's all done, I want to observe that work on the UI thread. And so that's going to be the Android main thread that we were talking about before. And then at that point, you get the result back. So it's kind of like an async task, which is one thing that a lot of people will usually say when they first view RxJava, RxAndroid, is they'll see this, a lot of code that doesn't really make sense to them. And they'll think, like, why do I even need to do that? I can just do this in async as an async task. And I think that's the big drawback. And they really don't see the real benefit until you get to the point where you have one to n level of asynchronous threads that need to be executed at one point in time. And I know, Dan, you have a big love for async tasks, don't you?
Yeah, I hate
them. Yeah, Dan's a big fan of async tasks. I mean, he's written blog posts on how he loves async tasks.
I mean, I wrote a blog post a long time ago about async tasks saying, like, here's like four things that are really nasty about them, but if you know about them, you can work around it. And now I realize, like, that should have been that warning sign of like being in an abusive relationship, that when you're saying like, oh yeah, he does all these bad things, but it's still fine. Like, no, I shouldn't have been using him.
I still love async tasks. I still love it.
I think it's really important, the idea that you can create these observables and operators without having to tell it which thread to work on until the very end. Because so much of the time, you have to, if you're not doing that, you have to write your code in such a way that you handle the concurrency with every single task. So that's the real bad part. That's one of the real nasty parts about async tasks or just any sort of other threading solution, is that I have to make sure every one of these network calls does its own async task or does its own threading operation. With observables, I don't have to worry about any of that. If in the end the person just wants to run it all synchronously, they can. But I can also declare it to be running on another thread, and the code that comes before it doesn't have to change at all for whatever schedule you choose to use.
Exactly. So you could actually be using that same observable in one instance inside of a fragment, but later on you could be using it in a different part and different layer of your application that's already buried in some other IO-based call, correct?
Yep.
Excellent.
So we have basically touched on the general structure of RxJava. We've talked about schedulers and a bunch of stuff about concurrency and threading. But by and large, what is the most fun part about RxJava is essentially operators, right? Like chaining operators and the whole, like, you can do a lot of like cool stuff with the operators. So maybe we should spend some time and talk about like the most commonly used operators, the most the operators that each of us consider a favorite and are beneficial. So let's start off with some of these operators. So Dan, what are like some of the most important operators that you work with?
Well, you got to start from somewhere, and the observable has to be created somehow. And the two main ways that I create observables is using observable.just and observable.from. The difference being, just emits a single item that happens to be whatever variable you put in, and from emits a series of items based on some list or iterator. You could be using observable.create to create your observables, but that's a much more manual process. And sometimes you need that level of control, but most of the time you're just emitting items, so it's not a big deal. And then in particular, when people are migrating code, they tend to wonder, like, how do I actually get my old code? Like, I don't want to have to rewrite all my old code for the new code.
Yes, that's such a big problem.
You can take an old method that returns, you know, object, and wrap that in observable.just, and now you have that observable for that. But in between, the problem is now when you create the observable, that's the moment you call the method. What you really want is for that method to be called when the observable is subscribed to. And so for those cases, I use this operator called defer. And defer essentially says, run this code once I'm actually subscribed to. And so you can say observable.just, and then defer the actual action until later.
So do you need to wrap the just inside of a defer, or can you just call defer after you create a just or a from?
I don't remember exactly.
Okay. I know that you covered it in your blog post. I don't know if it was number 3 or number 4 in your blog post. That was the real key moment for me, because I was taking a lot of existing code I had in async tasks and needed to move it over into RxJava, and I had that real blocking point where I thought, like, I need to get past this. I need to be able to move this code into RxJava. And I didn't know how to do it. And when I saw the defer method and the way you would explain it in the blog post, really clicked for me. So we'll make sure that that's in the show notes for people that are interested on how to migrate from their existing code into RX pattern.
The word migrate freaks people out. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who they say, oh, I don't want to use RxJava because I don't want to have to migrate all my code. RxJava isn't something that you have to go in whole hog on. Like, you
That's
can
true.
Do it piece by piece. You could have, you can really experiment. You could just have a single fragment be using RxJava, and the whole rest of your code can still be the same.
Yeah, so, well, that's what we do. That's what we do right now. I'm doing over at Point. We have a bunch of code that's using async task, and there was some definite benefits where I needed to use RxJava, and that's exactly what I did. I used it just for that one particular vertical area of the app, and I'm now using it more and more and expanding it. So I definitely agree with you. You can use it when you need to. You don't have to go whole hog.
So that was observable just and from and defer. Okay, so Don and I have a bunch of more stuff that we want to go through with Dan, but we understand that some of our listeners are probably at the end of their commute or their journey. So we're going to wind this show down now, but fear not. We will return in episode number 4, where we'll continue to discuss some more RxJava operators. And definitely stay tuned for that one, because Dan has some really cool RxJava tips and tricks that he'll cover again. Thanks again for listening. You can find the show notes for this episode at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/3. If you have feedback or suggestions for us, as always, please send them to us directly by tweeting at us, or you can just write in your comments at our show notes. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for episode number 4.